Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live event held in Dublin in November 2025. Now, as we roll into the new year, we're taking a look at the food trends that are defining the industry. How does a trending flavour make it from social media hype to supermarket shelves? And why do some innovations succeed while others end up gathering dust in warehouses? Our expert panel will guide you through in our look ahead to 2026 and beyond.
So I'd like to welcome onto stage our speakers, Niamh Branally, who's the Head of Nutrition and Scientific Communication for UK and Ireland for Danone, Adam Townsley, Head of Food and Beverage Development for Yo Sushi, Ben Richardson-Hughes, who's the Food Development Manager for Green King, and John Brennan, our Category Director for Fresh Foods for Tesco. You're all very welcome. Good morning, everybody. I know I've got to chat to one or two of you this morning already, but for those I haven't seen yet, you're so very welcome. I want to start by asking each of you, just tell us a little bit about how your business actually works. How do you go from insight to execution? What are sort of the top tips or maybe the top secrets that you do within your organization that you could share with the audience? And John, I'll start with yourself, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure. Morning, Annie.
Morning.
Great to be here, everybody. We're a kind of a big business, big retail business, millions and millions of customers every week. So we have tons and tons and tons of customer data driven by our own kind of club card, but also we rely heavily on data from our valued supplier partners. So that sounds like a kind of a good thing, but sometimes with that much data, it can be kind of difficult to understand what to aim the gun at, so to speak.
Data is only as good as the interpretation of the data.
Exactly, yeah. So we use a kind of a really simplified process of segmenting our customers. So when it comes to innovation and when it comes to the insight and that insight arriving on a shelf edge in product form, we're able to use six different customer segments. They're the obvious ones you'd expect. Our marketing team put funny names on them. I can't remember them all at the moment. But it's things around...
Which one are you, John?
I don't know. I changed. I flip and flop. But there are indulgence seekers, empty nesters, kind of value seekers, things like that as well. But by grouping all the data together, we've all this rich information on what customers buy and maybe what they would want to buy.
Okay.
And it actually enables the innovation process that we're able to put this into different boxes, so to speak.
Brilliant. And I'll come back and ask you a little bit more just about what those pockets are and the timings and the agility around it. Ben, you're very welcome. Tell us a little bit about your business and how it works.
So Green King has about 2,000 sites in England, Scotland and Wales. Those sites are divided into brands, some of which you would have heard of and be customer facing, some of which would be more community based, pubs and restaurants. Similar to what John said, we segment our customers as well into different categories based on what they're likely to spend, where they're likely to eat, and what they're likely to order and what they're looking for. The overwhelming majority of those customers are traditional customers. They're coming to us for a specific reason, what we do very well. So the likes of steaks and pies and fish and chips being an example. But of course, we can play in the innovation as well with the periphery of the menus. We are data-driven as well, but it is part of the puzzle. It's not always the be-all and end-all. It will help give you a great steer, and your customers will tell you what they want, but their actual behaviour when they walk into one of our pubs and restaurants may differ. So it's part of the puzzle, but as a chef and a creator myself, it's not always the be-all and end-all, and we challenge that internally as well.
Of course, and unlike, I guess, Tesco and Clubcard, you don't have a loyalty scheme within the business or within the brands?
So we have an app.
Okay,
so
very good.
The more people that can order on the app, the more stuff we can track, but not specifically like card now.
Great. Okay. Adam, you're very welcome.
Thank you. I think, you know, we are bombarded with information and insights. I think it's really important to firstly understand how to distill that into the needs of the business. And I think if you're not careful, you can procrastinate with too much information. You know, I think there's an element where it can just become busy noise. It can stop decision making. So making sure, one of the key things for us is making sure we've got key decision makers that allow you to, you know, sort of really drive your strategy in and around the insights that you're given, because, you know, insights and trends are key to obviously driving the business forward. But if you're not careful, they can, you know, you can end up driving yourself down a rabbit hole. So yeah, I think really
procrastinating in the data and then not making the decision.
Absolutely. I think that's so, yeah. So having a really strong senior food team, you know, key decision makers that can sort of, you know, be that from commercial, technical, you know, food.
The right people in the right room, absolutely, making decisions at the right time.
Yeah, and then you will.
Really simple.
Yeah, absolutely. Then you've got a single-minded approach to where you're going.
Yeah, super. Niamh, you're very welcome. Thanks. Tell us a little bit about Danone.
Thanks, and thanks for having me here today. So at Danone, we're a global food company. So a little bit like Tesco, there's massive insights coming from all different directions. But per country, we segment the countries. We segment the countries, but then we segment the customers based on the brand. So brands that I'm responsible for would be Activia, Actimel, we have Evian, Volvic, Alpro, and also we have a sports range. So GetPro. So we really then look at sort of what the consumer wants per brand and segment them per brand. So if it's in sports, what are the key things they're looking for in a product to deliver the end goal? So that's one part. We have a dedicated insights team looking at that locally in the UK, but we also have global insights that feed in to sort of see, okay, what they're saying in Europe and the rest of the world, is that reflective of what's seen in the UK and Ireland, which I'm now responsible for. They look at also social listening. So we look at all the different platforms, because for the newer, younger users, you want to sort of get their insights from. They're not on Facebook or LinkedIn and the old fashioned platforms that I'd be on. They're on TikTok, Instagram and various platforms where they're actually, those trends and what's happening in these platforms are actually the big drivers in terms of what's influencing the biggest trends. So we play a role there. But in my side of the business, I'm really responsible for nutrition, and Danone is all about driving health through food. So we then also look at what is the data saying in terms of health and nutrition and the health of the nation. So we look at scientific studies showing a snapshot of what people are eating and what deficiencies they may have in the population. So that also influences sort of consumers' perception of health and what's good for them. And then we actually adapt. We take those insights all together, and that's actually, so it could be in the Irish population, UK, most of the world, we have low intakes of fiber. So we, knowing that, we then, using that example, would try to adapt the innovation pipeline based on the consumer needs, health needs, and then that would be sort of the strategy we have for products.
So brilliant. So thinking macro, but also sort of more micro, and then trying to bring it all together.
Bring it all together, yeah.
It's really good. I want to hone in on agility, because as you said, we can kind of get lost in the data, and then obviously there's a whole load of other things that need to happen in order for us to get a product onto shelf. How agile is your business at the moment? And perhaps maybe with an example of sort of from start to finish, how you've managed to I suppose, bring agility into your business, and also, you know, that it has helped with the growth that we're all looking for these days. And again, I won't start with John, because I feel like I'm going to hone in on you the whole time, John. So maybe Adam, if you wanted to take that question first from a UCP perspective.
Sure. It's funny because it's almost countering your question, because how we become more nimble is to be working further ahead.
Yeah.
Because obviously the challenges we've seen in supply chain, all those sorts of things that we're dealing with. But I think by building a strategy much further out, it allows us to take those opportunities when they come along. So, because what can quite often happen is that you can become so head down working on the day to day, and if you're not working, you know, progressively in advance, then you don't have the space or the bandwidth to sort of take on those really great opportunities that can really drive the business forward. So I think building your strategy much further out, so you don't remove yourself from the core needs of the business, allows you that sort of breadth.
But is it difficult in these days to sort of plan too far in advance, given just how much is sort of out of our control?
Well, I think it goes back to what we were talking about before in insights, so having a clean direction.
Yeah.
And a very clear sort of creative pathway. But equally, you know, when you're talking about the scale of the businesses that most of us are involved in, getting hold of those raw materials from throughout the world is time consuming. It's never taken so long. So I think you've got to be able to plan those in. Otherwise, I mean, we've seen in the past where you rush at things and you drop all the eggs. So you've got to be organized.
Of course, Ben, an example of something from an agility perspective that maybe you launched recently.
It's interesting because obviously a lot of our menus will be physically printed. So we can be agile by being fairly nondescript on some of our dish names, for example. That gives our buying team the flexibility to move out of one product to another with volatile buying markets for food ingredients. So that's one way of doing it. In terms of tapping onto what the next trend might be, we have a 6-month development process, which is probably quite average for a business of our size.
What's average? Give us an idea. What's average time-wise? From start to finish for a launch?
24 weeks.
24 weeks.
For a full menu. Wow. But you can go outside of that with a limited time offer, for example, and we do that. So one of the brands I look after is a carvery brand, known for its very large cakes, and we run a quarterly competition with the people in our sites to come up with what the next flavour would be. So we can kind of reduce that down to sort of 2-3 months.
Very good. Niamh?
Yeah, so we have an example. For instance, we launched a skier product. So think the first discussion on clean label, that became a big trend. So when you say, how do you do and be agile? We get a project team together. We get the insights, really act on the insights. I said, we need a product sort of yesterday, but that doesn't happen that fast in Dunome. We wouldn't have. It takes a lot of time because we have a European, we're sort of a European line as well. So what we do in the UK sort of influences Europe. So we all have to align, which takes some time. So you take in the insights, the full R&I team, and also then the CCD team, so the sales team that's linking in with retailers to really find out, do they want it? If we do it, what's the value to do this? So then it really then if you can put a figure to it to say, this is the sort of the business we can generate, then that gets the teams going. So,
and that feels like a really clear brief up front, maybe? So everybody kind of...
Everyone's aligned and everyone's on the same page.
So it's not working in silos. Working together,
and then you get the end goal. And we did it with Danone Skier. It's not yet in Ireland, but it will come to Ireland. We had a similar thing for Kefir we launched this year as well. But with the Skier product, it was actually the most successful launch we had this year.
And just in comparison, sorry, Niamh, to Ben's 24-week, how long?
I was 24 weeks is like a dream for us. It would be, we say agility is fast, like would be a year and a half.
But it's important, obviously, a year and a half or 5 years, your business can mean, a year and a half can still mean agile. It's just to kind of understand the length of time that it takes from sort of early ideation right through to execution.
And you can be hit with different things along the way. Like when we had the skier, they were like, we should have actually probably added in this, but then it's too late because the brief is locked. So again, long-term planning sometimes doesn't, you have to be sort of fast to get the product out.
Test and learn.
Getting the whole project team on board, having the goal in sight and then launching. So yeah, it sounds like it's easy, but it's quite a process. But we eventually get there.
Very good. John, I'm sure you're going to tell me that Tesco has always been agile. Because in retail is agile.
I mean,
it moves a million miles an hour.
I think we went into a crisis in COVID and never came out of it. You could describe some of our teams as the crisis management team rather than, particularly the produce guys, you're looking at seasons that don't start when they're meant to start and don't end when they're meant to end. And that just puts a lot of pressure on supply chains. Every day, genuinely every day, there is something different. So AI, and not the AI you were talking about earlier, is in my world at the moment, avian influenza. That's a real problem. And it's just, customers want everything every day and they want the best products and it's up to us to give them that. And that has its own challenges with sustainability and what have you. But genuinely every day, something is happening in the world that has an impact on the food that we're eating. So we're the same. We plan for 6 months out, but even if I was sitting here this time last year, I wouldn't have foreseen the food inflation that was about to hit. And that had a major change on, particularly talking about beef. I would have thought it'd definitely come off a lot of your menus as well. But I mean, the different cuts and the different packs and the different breeds and whatever has fundamentally changed, and then that impact on into other proteins, and it's all a circle. So every day you're kind of managing that. So absolutely, you can look far down the line, but you need to be really in tune with what's right ahead of you, and that's in today.
Yeah, Yeah. And you've done quite a lot of work in, say, if I just take bakery within the fresh food category, yeah, in terms of, I suppose, reinventing bakery.
Yeah.
Are you sort of applying that same model to your other fresh food categories, or is it a bit more difficult to do it in other categories because there are other challenges?
No, I mean, look, I mean, we strategically looked at our overall fresh business. It was our under trade. Bakery was the obvious one to go after. We had a bakery background. We used to put our bakeries at the back of our store. Didn't make any sense. You get a chance every 20 years to change a store around, you know, with CapEx and all that kind of stuff. So we took that chance, brought all our fresh to the front. And bakery is one category, particularly in Ireland, that's really, really important, that the frequency is really, really high.
We like the craft. High,
and we do like our bakery.
We do.
So, yeah, I mean, you fix one element or you improve one element. It's like painting a room in your house. You think you can get away with painting the kitchen. When you walk out to the hall, you go, geez, that looks a bit crap now, doesn't it? So you end up painting everything.
Shows up all the
same. So every category got it, and then everything gets a lift.
Very good, very good. Niamh, I know one of the burning questions I have for you is, how do you take all of the science, and particularly in an organization like yours, and distill it in a way that you're able to communicate it simply to us shoppers who are sort of inundated with messages and just need it called out simply? How does that process work, and how have you managed to do it successfully?
It's quite a big job because I'm not sure if you're aware, but there's two different sides of Danone. We also have a medical side, which actually you would think would be more regulated and more difficult to distill messages from research to patients via healthcare professionals. That's actually an easy gig. This side of the business with consumers is much more complicated because, say, the most science-backed brands you would have would be Activia, and we have 41 clinical studies, and Actimel, we have 140 studies behind those products showing the efficacy, say, for Actimel on immune health and then Activia on good health, you know, improving good health. But despite the fact we have good science, you can't really communicate that to consumers. You can't put medical claims on packs. You're not permitted to do so in terms of regulatory perspective. So it can be quite difficult to actually distill quite complicated studies right down into a one-liner that you think how, you know, like the value of the study and all the evidence, you know, supporting the study goes into one line. But yeah, it takes some time, but it's just simplifying the message into something that consumers will appeal to. And we do a lot of testing. So we do a huge amount. We actually bring consumers in. We ask them the questions, you know, what does this mean to you? So for instance, when I say science-backed brand, that's appealing to me because I'm a bit of a nerd, because I am a scientist. But to a consumer, actually, they don't want to see science-backed brand. They just want something simple. This supports good health. That's it. Simple. No more than that. And maybe this supports immune function, say, for Actimel. So it's bringing the consumer in, asking them, letting them test the product, and maybe just also asking them, what would you expect to see in a product and what would that mean to you? So really bringing the consumer to the center, bringing that complicated science in and asking them the questions of what's appealing to them.
Brilliant. And maybe the same question for the rest of you on the panel, but appreciation it's not necessarily science back that you're trying to communicate, but how do you land those really clear messages that then support the sort of product innovation landing really well? Because if we confuse consumers, we know that, you know, they may not engage, they may not pick that product up. Adam, I might ask you share first.
I think what's key for us, I mean, we sit in a very Gen Z space.
Yes.
Our customer set's really clear. They diamonds until they're 35, have a 10-year hiatus and then come back. So basically, they grow up, have kids, you know, and then come back when the kids are old enough to sort of enjoy. So I think what's really important for us is that it's the power of talkability. Everything's got to be talkable. Everything that we do, the trends and the hype doesn't last as long.
Okay.
So got to be able to sort of distill it down into talkable content. And for us, that really sort of helps to drive that sort of mass appeal and that mass reach.
Any particular example that comes to mind, maybe of recent?
I think we, due to the nature of the bulk of our, well, not the bulk of our business, but the bulk of the brand, which is obviously Yo, which obviously sits in restaurants, the bigger part of our business is obviously manufacturing and retail. But the brand sits in retail, in restaurants. And, you know, Japanese cuisine and Korean is massively hyped at the moment. It's very popular. It's on every menu. And it's being able to sort of bring back those idiosyncrasies from abroad And quite often when you go to regional, when you look into regional foods, and that can be French to Japanese to Southeast Asian, they're quite polarizing, you know, when you look at it in their traditional form. So you've got to be able to bring it back in a way that can either relate to a great memory or a great travel,
yeah,
but in a way that's got mass appeal. So it can be something as simple. If we use a simple example of something that's trending massively at the moment, like bubble tea. Now, if you take a brown milk bubble tea with taro and what have you, that's not got mass appeal. But you drop in a flavor like salted caramel or something like that. It's that 80-20 approach where it's sort of, and it works both ways depending on the ingredient. It can be 80% of what they know and 20% of some sort of flavor nuance, or it can go the other way where it's 20% of what they know and the focus is on the key ingredient. It just kind of depends on how polarizing and exactly where the trend is in the market, because we've been, and I'm sure we all have probably been at fault of jumping too soon. Matcha is a prime example. You know,
we've been scarred by it. Don't mention that word again.
Yeah,
but it was just because we were too early in the market.
Well, this is it. And sometimes you need the retailers to push it first, and then sometimes the retailers need independence to sort of drive it through. So pokey was a prime example for us. You know, we had pokies in our restaurants 15 years ago. It was just too soon, and it wasn't until our factory put it into Waitrose and everyone started buying pokey bowls through Tyco that all of a sudden that surge jumped through the roof. So
it was led by retail initially before.
Well, led by restaurants. The innovation was driven through restaurants and then moved into.
But successful in retail before it was really successful in restaurants.
Yeah,
because you tend to see the food service drives trends into retail. So that's
it's got that broader sort of scope and reach. So yeah.
That stuff's really difficult for retailers because we're a big bus to move as well. So quite often we'd be in there and all of a sudden, and I'm going to be reminded of, I hope nobody's in here from Prime or Dubai Chocolate or some of that stuff, because if there is, or anyone wants to buy any of that stuff, and a few trucks left over, probably, I'm not sure about the shop life, but we come into this stuff really late and then we're left with it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because we can't necessarily be that nimble.
Because you're not that agile.
Yeah. Yes. Well, you can be agile to a point. But then when it gets on to the trend, we rely on these guys. They're much cooler than us, you know. And that's where it really starts, particularly with brands. And when it comes to own label usually follows behind the big brands,
of course.
But only when it's successful and safe to do so.
But again, I guess it's about collaboration. It's about sharing those insights. It's about bringing the retailer on the journey, you know, before you even bring the consumer on the journey. Mm. Taking the retailer's insights and support and then driving it through will make it much more successful.
Each retailer wants their own hook. And, you know, you're constantly developing new products and NPD that everyone wants to sort of stake their claim on. But it's sometimes, you know, you need to have that great sort of partnership relationship where they're willing to also stake their claim on that piece of NPD. Otherwise, all of a sudden, you miss the boat, you know.
Yeah. Ben, thoughts on that?
As I mentioned earlier, because our customers are quite traditional, we have the luxury of being able to wait a little bit, even though that might be a frustration for us as individuals. But they like what they like. So take something like halloumi, which has been around for quite some time. That's still one of our top sellers in our sort of small plates or sharers range, be it fried, battered or whatever. It still resonates now because our customers think that's new.
That's trendy.
And to build on that with the Korean theme that Adam mentions, we have that on our menus, but we're not going to go with a traditional Korean dish. It just wouldn't work. But we play in other parts of our menu. We take that classic dish that they would know, be it chicken wings, and we put it with a different sauce. And it's just that twist on.
So it's comfort and familiarity. Absolutely. And then little twist. But you would say that's the case in retail as well. We're all creatures of habit. We know there's a sort of 80-20 rule in many categories. And I'm looking at you, John. You know, we buy, you know, regularly the same thing, and then we are caught by, you know, being interested in something. But a lot of us, you know, are not early adapters, so therefore, you know, it can take quite some time before something resonates or becomes, you know, a core part of a category.
People generally eat the same thing. I mean, I think the Board Beer report that comes out every few years on what Ireland is eating is pretty much the similar thing, because people are really busy. Whatever life stage that they're in, you know,
prep is coming back into fashion as well, as in prepping food because people are so busy, but people are generally eating the same thing. But then we're also seeing people getting more curious and, you know, maybe exploring at the weekends or at different times on the holidays and stuff.
Or racing through because they've seen it on social media.
There's a huge amount of social media and TikTok and all that kind of stuff as well. Yeah.
Niamh, what's the cut through tips, I suppose, on trying to get recognised, particularly in the categories that you're in, which, you know, is they're quite saturated with lots of different brands. What little tricks have worked within your own organisation that really help to kind of, you know, get consumers' attention?
I think, again, going back to the point on science, although we can't communicate hugely about science, but we have long heritage already in the brands that we have, which is great. Consumers recognise them. It's probably Activia now was the yogurt my mum would have probably bought back then. So there's a long heritage. And then the science part and really trying to cut through all the noise and really come with evidence-based messages where you can with consumers to sort of explain the functional benefit, the health benefit of a product. And that lands well. If you're coming with something, consumers and actually retailers, and we work a lot with Tesco, Sainsbury's, all the big retailers, it's really nice now because they have a massive focus on health as well. They all have an ambition to be the healthiest retailer, which is lovely. So when we come in the UK, there is sort of, they classify food as healthy or non-healthy with criteria known as HFSS, so high fat, sugar and salt. We don't do the same in Ireland, but we have a very large portfolio, which is 98% non-HFSS. So they like to talk to us to help them meet their ambitions for health. But they often will ask questions down to that level of granularity. So if you have a new, say, innovation in gut health, they want to know what strains you have in, down to that point, what's the evidence behind them, because they want to ensure they're providing the best product for the consumers to give the shelf space to your product. So they will have that level of sort of detail, which is for me is sort of amazing because they're not nutrition background, but they know what the consumer wants. So we're getting the intel in from the retailers. We have our own intel, but they're saying, we're basically not going to give you more shelf space unless you can show us from a health perspective, you're ticking the box, but also from research and, you know, and innovation, you have the science that delivers the functional benefit that you have on pack.
Brilliant. So science and keeping it simple.
Keeping it simple. Yeah.
Adam?
Sorry.
So just what's the cut through kind of tips that have worked in your business in terms of getting consumers to sort of, you know, see new innovations, see new products? What's worked either on the restaurant side of the business or in retail?
I think like I said before, sort of really getting out there socially, because of the audience that we're playing to. I think that backed with the insight work that we started with and making sure that we're actually, you know, we're not just going at stuff gung-ho. We're really sort of targeting campaigns because I think for us as well, that sort of experiential piece where we're actually developing food for a reason as opposed to just willy-nilly blue sky thinking and throwing loads of sort of creative out there. I think, you know, for us, creating food for the people as opposed to creating food for the development chefs, you know, that the chefs want to eat. So I think, yeah, so really sort of just being really targeted with our approach.
Very good. Ben?
I think one area we've seen work really well in this space is sort of the growth of small plates and sharers and social sorts of eating and targeting that market. So people will come out for a drink and then share, you know, two or three bowls or whatever with a family or a friend. That's something that's worked quite well for us. There's something else I think that will remain in our industry rather than a big heavy meal.
Of course, with the cost of living, I think everybody's, yeah, of course, thinking about how much they're spending when they go out, but knowing that the social aspect of life is really important. It's just that sort of, you know, budget constraints sometimes can lead us. So sharing plates, you've seen real success across the business or specifically within certain brands?
Across all brands. And also for us, it's where we can add value to what people have come in for. Can we upsell them something? You know, it's not just a side of chips anymore. It's loaded fries. That's the thing. It's can you increase their spend and drive their expectation and satisfaction ultimately?
John, what's resonating with the Tesco consumer and what are they buying more of now than maybe they had been a couple of years ago, and what's working to sort of drive that?
We've kind of done a huge amount on range over the last number of years, but we've taken it from it's not just a product, it's a proposition. So it's actually how we set it up in stores. So we're trying to create meal solutions. So and particularly dialing that up
when people are at home more. So bank holidays, Halloween just gone. We just had the Finest Meal Deal. It's across, and it's kind of a more healthier version. So it's not necessarily in the ready meal space. So we're trying to move from creating products to creating propositions. Really, we're finding that really, really works. Now at a really keen price. So affordability is still really, really key, and actually getting more and more so. So that's just something we're wary of, and we have that across our fresh and our frozen areas.
Very good, very good. Brilliant. Ben, just going back to something you said earlier about sort of, you know, the heritage that you have in the brand, and then sort of balancing it with the innovation. I suppose what sort of things do you feel consumers what do you call your consumers, your shoppers? What do you call them? Consumers. I was thinking drinkers or eaters, whatever. So what sort of resonates with them in terms of getting them to just sort of, I suppose, buy more? So maybe, as you know, spend that £2 or £3 more. What do you feel is working? And maybe it's the same for yourself, Adam, as well.
So, I mean, we can. It depends on the demographic that they are, what they're looking for. If they're looking for value, they will always want value. You can drive that a little bit with 2, 4, 3, 4 courses, set menus, that sort of thing. But because we over-index in value anyway as a business, we're already at that end of the market. So we don't put too many discounts on there like our competitors would. We just try to be, have a very good price from the outset. We recently ran an unlimited carvery offer, which was $9.99, including a soft drink, which is incredible value to create noise, to help with our market share. So I think going after affordability for us is probably one of our key macro trends, and always will, because it's the philosophy of what we do.
And keeping menus fresh, I guess, is really important as well, but without being too crazy with global flavors, so that's what I'm getting a sense of.
Yeah, absolutely. For the majority of the business, we do have brands where we can play in that area, and we have a couple of premium brands where that will work, but the majority of the business, it is that traditional customer base, and tourism as well. So a lot of our sites will be in city centres, London, Stratford, Cambridge, and people come to us for a reason, for that traditional fish and chips, for example.
Very good. And Adam, you mentioned Korean, Japanese, sort of hot at the moment. Yeah. What are the sort of flavours within those two cuisines finding?
I guess it's that big fusion piece, isn't it? That sort of crave-worthy big fusion that we're sort of starting to see, really. I mean, you sort of spoke about how we amalgamate the different cuisines into single dishes. And I think as the power of the trend starts to dissipate slightly, people start to look at ways to sort of elaborate and to keep that trend going. So I think that sort of mashup of we're seeing everything from katsu lasagna sandos to
got that on your shelf yet, John?
Definitely not. No, a big sort of mashup.
Wait,
sort of
cold, wouldn't happen for me.
Yeah, so I think it's really sort of trying to, like I said, it's for us, it's about being talkable, and that can be. We put a lot into disruptive development. Yes, we've got to keep the EPD going. Yes, we've got to keep the fresh development to freshen and bring the menu alive. But what really works for us is that disruptive piece where we sort of just break the market. It doesn't necessarily need to be our top selling lines, but what it does do is sort of bring people in.
Okay, so it drives the footfall.
Yeah, it drives footfall.
So they may come in because they're... Yeah, they're caught by it on social media, but then go back to their.
I think the UK,
their familiar product that they
have been built like that for years. You launch a new menu. I mean, it's very rarely do you ever break into your top five. You know, in a French restaurant, it's a French onion soup, chicken liver parfait, and probably calamari or prawns or something of that sort of ilk. And then, but in essence, to what we said before about cultural foods, when you go to France and actually very rarely see those in all the restaurants, right? Because they're using a lot more seasonal produce. So I think for us it's when you launch a menu, how do you get them in? And then quite often it's just about you'll quite often see them sort of maybe try it once or what have you, but you brought them in and then they go back to their comfort zone, if you like.
Brilliant. So I'm going to open it to the floor for a couple of questions shortly, but just to give you one more question to each of you, and it's about predicting. So if you had a crystal ball, or perhaps you have all the data and insights that you need to predict what the sort of biggest trend will be in the next 5 years, what's the one thing that we should all be looking out for? John, I'll start with you first.
I'd be surprised if half of us don't say GLP-1. I know Marcelo kind of mentioned it, and we're all kind of, we can all share our own thoughts, and there's lots of different consultants advising lots of us on different things, so we don't actually know. But the one thing we do know, it is going to change the way we eat, what we eat, how often we eat. You know, there's the people think that it's the end of the world. There's an opportunity in every crisis, if you will. I'm not calling it a crisis, but we do need to understand it a bit sooner, a bit quicker, and we do need to collaborate together to understand, well, what does that mean? And there's a lot of us probably on this panel already doing it together anyway, you know, in terms of that kind of collaboration. But it will transform the way people eat, because there'll also be not just people taking that medication, but the halo effect of that medication, and that also how that actually feeds into the bigger picture, which is the health and well-being agenda. That's already there.
And you had your supplier conference recently, yeah, didn't you? So was that one of the things that you sort of talked about? Or?
Not really. Okay. Not really. I think it'll probably feature more the next one. Yeah, it's okay. Still one to think about.
Yeah.
We are definitely talking about it with our suppliers more face-to-face than en masse, particularly the ones that it will impact.
Have you launched anything sort of GLP-1 targeted within the Tesco offering? Currently.
Not under our own brand, but brands are working at pace in this space, I think, as well. So it is typically around the dairy space, typically around high protein, low sugar. Products do exist. That's the halo effect thing I'm saying. But it is a watch this space because it's coming.
Brilliant. Ben, appreciating you're in tradition and comfort, and GLP may not come to you in the next 5 years, but
it's a really good question, because obviously we're in the indulgence part of the sector. People are coming to us for that treat occasion, and so they're perhaps not thinking about their health when they walk through our door. That said, we have to be mindful that groups of people coming in, I think it's 10% of people are on it now, something like that, so it might affect them. So how does that translate into our menus? Probably through the lights of small plates, like I mentioned earlier, and sharers, that smaller appetite, eating slightly less, I would see as a trend that continues in conjunction with that. But we're probably not going to lead with that message, because that's not what we're about. And it will probably come to us slightly later on as well.
Of course. In 5 years, do you think?
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Very good. Thank you. Adam?
I think from a creative point of view, it's, you know, sort of feed the soul, no rules cuisine. We sort of touched on it just before, because there's an element where health, we're never getting away, well, certainly not. I don't think we ever have got away from the sort of health sort of spectrum, certainly not in the last, you know, sort of 5-10 years, and particularly moving forward into the future, as pre-mentioned. But it's just not about, it's not only about nutritional density and nourishment. It's equally about that sort of good mood food. Okay. You know, we go out for an occasion, we go out for an event, we go out to feel good.
So our mental health.
Yeah, and it's not just about, yeah, absolutely. So to your point, indulgence plays a massive part in that. You know, people like a treat, that, you know, so, and our customers certainly do. So I think making sure that we're sort of constantly creating in that space that makes people feel good, be that physically or mentally. And I think we're lucky that sushi's deemed as naturally is quite healthy. And we can sort of tag ourselves into things like protein and all that sort of stuff, you know. But yeah, I think,
Niamh, where will the science be in 5 years?
Well, I'll answer it a little bit differently. I hope the science is sort of focusing on innovations that drive a better intake of fibre. In UK and Ireland and across Europe, it's about 90% of the population from young children up to old age don't get enough fibre. That's a big thing that's been seen. It's not a new thing, but I have hopes, but I'm not sure that's going to be the direction. But in terms of where we see it going is more precision nutrition. So it's around sort of like a person, they have their own particular specific health needs, and they're selecting foods which fulfill their health needs. So could be GLP-1, you know, so what are they taking for GLP-1? More nutrient dense, high protein foods to fulfill their need. And maybe after GLP-1, what's next? So it's really around precision nutrition.
Precision, so yeah. Personalized to your own individual needs. Okay,
yeah.
Brilliant. We have time for questions. We've about 3 minutes or so for questions. So if anybody has a burning question, Nadine is roaming with the microphone. Brilliant. Just introduce yourself and your company as well, please. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Sophie. I work for Green King.
Sophie, how are you?
Good, thank you. Great talk. I just wanted to touch on some of the trend info. So nostalgia, I think, is one that have seen around for years, doesn't seem to be going away. It just kind of changes. So where do you see that sort of going in the future? Do you see it dying off anytime soon?
Anybody want to grab that one?
I don't see it dying off. I think it will change as consumers obviously age, and what is nostalgic to them will change over time, of course. I think we see that in our business more in desserts. That seems to resonate more with people, what they have the school dinners and particularly what they had with desserts, ice cream sundaes, banana splits, etc. always seem to have that comforting place in people's memory. But it will evolve, obviously, as that demographic shifts on.
Brilliant.
There's definitely something coming back around the Sunday roast and the Sunday dinner, which I think is really, really cool.
Great example.
So we're definitely seeing that at particular times, obviously at the weekend. And we think it's because people are so busy. It is that one time, you know, whatever family situation that you're in, that people are getting around the...
And the cost of eating out,
together. And the cost of eating out, I think, is probably helping that as well. So that's definitely a trend we're starting to see. I don't know if you can call it a trend if we're only starting to see it, but I'm going to call it a trend.
But I think it's always been there to some extent. We all kind of like comfort, don't we? We all like that familiarity, and we dip in and out of it at certain times.
Then everybody starts during the week to eat different things. If you're anything like my household anyway, like my son does this, my daughter does this, my wife, and everyone's incredibly
back busy. To the personalized nutrition.
But it's back around the table then for that one time, maybe on Sunday or Saturday. That's definitely something you're seeing that come through.
Brilliant. Adam?
I mean, food is, for a lot of people, quite emotive. So I think nostalgia plays into that massively, isn't it? Absolutely. I don't think it won't ever go away, but it seems to work itself in cycles. I mean, the rise of delivery and that sort of fake away movement, be that in retail or restaurants or whatever it might be. So, that comforting familiarity of that warm blanket when you eat, I think, is quite powerful. So
totally, I agree. Great question, thank you. Any other questions before we move on?
Hi, Belinda Quick from Be Quick Consulting. Just going back to that crystal ball idea, what would be the biggest barrier, your number one barrier that you see approaching on the horizon?
Great question.
I mean, I don't think anything's going to get cheaper anytime soon. I think the cost of manufacturing, the cycles, when we look at a commodity cycle, we're not necessarily seeing the lows, but we've definitely seen the highs. Mm-hmm. So that might be something there to stay, and that will feed into the products that we innovate and the NPD that we deliver, I think, as an industry.
I think for us, we alluded to it earlier, is that takeaway market, which we've seen massive growth in since COVID. There's more choice than ever for consumers to choose to go out or stay in, and there's data to support both. We don't just see other restaurants and pub companies as competitors. We now see streaming services as a competitor. And how do we get around that or play in those markets or offer our dishes for delivery? And we already do that with the likes of Just Eat, etc. And so it's bigger than just, you know, the restaurant down the road.
I think, I think we are already in that space of barriers, be that, you know, cost of living, be it procurement, be it just getting hold of produce in general. I think the rising cost of everything is something that we need to carefully manage, and a lot of these things are out of our control, unfortunately. In the UK and Ireland, we're not self-sufficient. We need to bring products in from abroad, to feed the masses, you know. So I think we're already in that space. I don't think it's definitely not getting any better. It might have slightly softened, but they're our biggest challenges moving forward.
The same cost and sustainability, because cost is a big barrier. If you have to, sourcing the right ingredients for the products can be quite difficult. So when we get them, if you want to put more fancy things into your product, it also drives up the cost. And you think, well, then we put that on the market, it's not very responsible because not everybody can afford that. So then that kind of also determines your decision as to what you put in the product because of cost. But sustainability as well, because consumers not only want a healthy product that ticks all the boxes elsewhere, but they want a lower carbon footprint. They want to know what they're buying is having a less impact on the environment, and also circular. The packaging is sort of in line with environmental and, you know, restrictions in the country. So they really want to know what they're buying is healthy, but also is good for the environment. And that's a barrier, because actually that sometimes can be more expensive.
Of course. Yeah. And it shouldn't be, but
yeah,
that's what we're facing into at the moment. Super. I think that's it for questions from the audience for now, just to try and keep ourselves on time. But a great panel. I really, really appreciate all of your insights. So just to say thank you to yourself, John, to Ben, to Adam, and to Niamh. I think you're around for the rest of the day. So if anybody wants to follow up with them specifically or has anything that they want to chat and share with them, then please find them. Thank you so much.
Thank you Anne.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Before you go, we have some exciting news to share. In 2026, we're hosting two major events. We'll be in London in June, and we're back in Rotterdam in September. Visit foodmatterslive.com to register and join us as we inspire the future of food.